My guest today, J.P. Soteel, is a freelance journalist, radio co-host, documentary filmmaker, and former broadcast producer in Washington, D.C. His weekly show, Inside the Headlines with the News Vandal, co-hosted by James Moore, airs every Friday on KRUU-FM, the community radio station in Fairfield, Iowa. Soteel's articles have appeared in The Guardian of London, Consortium News, AndyWar.com, and the L.A. Progressive. The most recent one that caught my eye was in the Consortium News entitled, "The Neocons' Grim Victory in Iraq," from which I plucked that quote from Paul Wolfowitz earlier, speaking at the recent summit hosted by President Obama in Washington. Let's start with me asking, JP, you're there?
I'm here.
Yeah, well, welcome. First of all, welcome to Takes on the World. You're my first Skype interviewer. Let's start with asking, what was Wolfowitz doing at a summit for presidents from Africa in Washington?
Well, you know, Paul Wolfowitz is an expert on development. Don't you know that, Jeff? He was, remember, president of the World Bank from 2005 to 2007. Of course, the World Bank appointment was his sort of gift after leaving the Bush administration. And then he had to eventually leave the World Bank because of a scandal involving his girlfriend, Shaha Riza, who somehow got a $60,000 raise shortly after he took over at the World Bank. But, you know, Africa is an emerging front in the war on terror, emerging front in sort of the corporate development and the hand-in-hand relationship between corporate development and U.S. military power. A lot of oil being discovered in sub-Saharan Africa, and the Chinese are very active in Africa. So the United States making a concerted effort, particularly through AFRICOM, which is the Pentagon's command structure, controlling Pentagon efforts in Africa, they're making a concerted effort to increase U.S. presence around Africa, I think to counter China specifically.
One of the thrust of your article was that the neocons, unlike the rest of the American people, the neocons see what happened in Iraq as a smashing success for them. Why don't you talk about how they built this thing up and brought it together?
You know, it's interesting. I was actually in Washington, D.C. working at the time during 9/11, the aftermath of 9/11, the lead up to the war. And then the war happened, turned into something of a scandal because it was seen eventually as a strategic blunder. How did they mismanage the war? You know, Paul Wolfowitz selling the war to Congress, saying it's going to basically pay for itself. And the dominant interpretation of the war is that it was essentially a failure. But I don't think that they ever thought it was a failure. I don't think they ever planned for democracy in Iraq. I think the plan itself was to create instability in the region, remove Saddam Hussein, and create essentially a vacuum that would suck in jihadis from around the world, sort of create an enemy, in a sense, that would perpetuate what they see as the continual rebuilding of America's defenses.
Well, you talk about the role that Saddam played as the backbone of the region's stability against the jihadists. Whatever else he was doing, he was seen as this major bulwark, that it, with him in place and his army in place, there was no room for them to develop as they had, let's say, in Afghanistan.
I'm not going to defend Saddam Hussein as a great leader, but the facts are clear. At the time of the first Gulf War, Iraq had the largest middle class in the Arab world. Women were allowed to be educated. Women did not have to wear Muslim garb in accordance with Sharia law. It was seen as a secular state. It was a state that had cooperated with the Reagan administration in opening up a war against Iran. Saddam Hussein, think of it this way, Jeff. Why did the United States have to rescue Christians in Iraq, and why did it have to rescue the Yazidi minority? Why were they even there? The reason they were there is because Saddam Hussein, say what you will about his brutal tactics, he actually allowed for a level of pluralism inside the secular state or regime of Iraq. And once he was removed, the bulwarks against religious fundamentalism, Wahhabism, which is an export from Saudi Arabia, all of these checks and balances in the heart of the Middle East, the Tigris and Euphrates River, were eliminated. And that opened up the Pandora's box for what we see now, where we see, ironically, that perhaps our best ally in the fight against this type of radical Islamic Wahhabism, they're called Salafis or Wahhabis, it depends on how you trace the roots, is Iran. Because Iran has also been a bulwark against the kind of jihadism that we associate with Al-Qaeda. Iran, very much an enemy of the Taliban in Afghanistan, very much an enemy of Al-Qaeda. And so here we are with this Pandora's box open, and the Islamic State, such as it is a direct result of the removal of this bulwark against jihadism, the bulwark being Saddam Hussein.
Well, it's interesting. Just after 9/11, Iran offered its sympathies to the United States, as well as offered to help. And then we had a neocon David Frum, a speechwriter for George Bush, create the Axis of Evil, and suddenly Iran was thrown into this Axis of Evil with Syria and Korea. And instead of being a potential ally against the jihadists, Iran was now, well, accused of being their ally. And obviously, this had certain ramifications that were being played out in the Middle East since.
Yeah, this is the Al-Qaeda whack-a-mole. Did Al-Qaeda pop up in Czechoslovakia or the Czech Republic meeting with members of the Iraqi government? Did Al-Qaeda end up being harbored in the deserts of Iran? Where did Al-Qaeda pop up? Where is Al-Qaeda? None of these links, even though Dick Cheney talked openly about these links on Sunday shows, none of these links ever proved to be true. There was just implication. It was guilt by association without even any proof of association, much like the famous mushroom cloud that was supposed to happen in the George Bush speech in the lead up to the Iraq War. You know, we don't want the next terror attack to be in the form of a mushroom cloud because of the aluminum tubes that really weren't aluminum tubes that were associated with Saddam Hussein. You know, the whole lead up to the war, and we can relitigate that. Jeff, I don't think it's necessary here with your audience to do so. They're well informed. That was basically a lie. We don't really like to say it's a lie. We like to say misled inside the Beltway or in our political conversation, but it was a lie. The oddity here is that the primary mover behind the kind of jihadism that dominates our headlines is not Iran. The primary mover is Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the star of the 20 of the I think it's like a dozen pages that are, or maybe two dozen pages that are blacked out of the 9/11 report. Former Senator Bob Graham of Florida has been trying to get that report declassified, to get those redacted pages opened up so that people can see the extent to which the Saudi government and the Saudi royal family was intertwined and involved in 9/11. We can't get that done. Then again, on the other hand, Iran is seen as this perpetual boogeyman, as you mentioned, David Frum and the Axis of Evil. Iran is evil, Iran is evil. But there is Saudi Arabia, which, by the way, is the world's leader in beheading as a form of punishment, which is something that obviously the Islamic State likes to engage in.
You refer to the expression I used in my introduction, the bait and switch, in which even though there were economic interests in Afghanistan, the idea of having an oil pipeline that would go through Afghanistan, which seems remote at the moment, but Afghanistan was not necessary to get the U.S. to go into Iraq. It was a bait-and-switch case in which immediately the neocons in Washington, who actually had been long pushing for taking out Saddam and didn't forgive George Bush Sr. for not doing it in 91, immediately focused on Iraq. And even today, many Americans believe that Saddam was somehow involved in 9/11. Perhaps you comment on that.
Well, you know, it's obvious. What was it that Rumsfeld said? There are no suitable targets for bombing in Afghanistan, which is why we had to go to Iraq. Former National Security Advisor Richard Clark has spoken repeatedly about this, wrote about this in his book, that almost immediately inside the war room after 9/11, everybody's attention shifted to Iraq. Iraq was obviously the target that they wanted all along. Let's lay some blame here also on the Clinton administration, because the Clinton administration bombed almost nonstop throughout the entire 90s when the inspectors were pulled out in 98. And I say pulled out because it's often said that they were forced out. But at that time, the inspectors were basically running out of places to inspect. He did not have weapons of mass destruction. The inspection team was starting to determine that in 97 and 98, pardon me. And right around the time the Monica Lewinsky thing was starting to heat up, the inspectors, Saddam finally said, hey, you know, I've had enough of this. I would like to be deemed in compliance so I can start trading my oil on the open market. Oil at that time was around, fluctuated between $13 and $17 a barrel, which is a stunning number if you think about it, Jeff. And had Saddam Hussein been able to trade oil, imagine how he could have driven the price down and punished the Saudis. And the Saudis well aware that Saddam wanted to punish them for his support of the United States in the Gulf War and during the sanctions regime. You know, Clinton basically pulled those inspectors out and then began a bombing campaign of Baghdad to punish Saddam. And that kind of froze Iraq in a position where there was still some supposed, it was an open question supposedly whether or not he still was in, whether or not he was in compliance or whether or not he had weapons of mass destruction. And that kind of set the table for the Bush administration. And then, of course, 9/11 happens, and they got that perfect bait-and-switch opportunity. They couldn't pass it up.
Well, you know, an interesting thing I mentioned earlier before I called you about the role of the Project of a New American Century, which came a year after several key neocons who were helped orchestrate the war in Iraq, Richard Pearl, Doug Feith, and David Wormser, helped to prepare a paper for Benjamin Netanyahu called A Clean Break, and in which the first thing they wanted Netanyahu to do, was necessary for Israel to do, was to take out Saddam. And then a year later, we had the Project for New American Century, in which taking out Saddam was the first thing on its agenda. And I find that really significant, because then when they came into, and Bush came into office in 2000, Wormser, Feith, and Pearl had important positions within the Bush administration to push that war. So there are many people who see Israel as having benefited because their main solid target, their main nation that they saw as a threat, Iraq, was also eliminated. Maybe comment on that.
Well, you know, how does Israel benefit from what's going on in the Middle East? I think as long as there is instability in the Middle East, let's put it this way, the more instability there is, the better Israel's position is vis-a-vis the American government and U.S. support for Israel's position, particularly its position vis-a-vis the West Bank and Gaza. Of course, one of the reasons I think Iran is such a face of evil, according to Benjamin Netanyahu, and is constantly part of his drumbeat, is that Iran, unlike Saudi Arabia, unlike the United Arab Emirates, unlike the Gulf states in general, is a steadfast supporter of both Hamas and Hezbollah in Lebanon. They are quite concerned and quite supportive of the Palestinians in both the West Bank and Gaza, in ways that Saudi Arabia is not, in ways that the Gulf states are not. And this creates another set of strange bedfellows, where basically you have Saudi Arabia and Israel and the United States really all on the same page. They were all on the same page also about Iraq, it seems to me. And that destabilization of Iraq predicated a couple things. One, it solidified Israel's support as the lone bulwark of democracy. I'm making air quotes here, Jeff. Bulwark of democracy in the Middle East. The second thing it did, the United States had a difficult time keeping troops in Saudi Arabia after the first Gulf War. Of course, you end up with the Khobar Towers bombing. And one of the things that motivated Osama bin Laden was the presence of U.S. troops in the sacred land of Saudi Arabia. So troops in Saudi Arabia becomes untenable throughout the course of the 90s. What Iraq does, in addition to taking out Saddam Hussein and creating this vacuum of power and instability, which predicates a rationale for continued military spending, it also created a permanent military presence in the Gulf states. Right now in Bahrain, there is a $500 million upgrade of the Fifth Fleet's facilities there in Bahrain happening right this very minute. It is a permanent military presence there in the Gulf. It's something that cannot be sustained in Saudi Arabia, but can be sustained in these Gulf states. That's another sort of net effect of what has happened as a result of what the Project for a New American Century, sort of checking off their wish list, right? Support of Israel, check. Permanent military presence in the Persian Gulf, check. Now you have this additional problem here with what's going on with the Islamic State. And frankly, I think that they, you know, part of the neocon wish list, if you said, hey, what if we can get you an autonomous Kurdish state operating in that region between Turkey and Iran, close to the Caspian Sea? You know, you did mention the TAPI pipeline that's scheduled to go from the Caspian Sea down into Pakistan and in the Indian Ocean. If you could get that sort of Kurdish oil state built there, would that be okay with you neocons? They would probably say check. It's a radical reformation of the power structure as it was before the neocons came into power with the Bush administration. And in some ways, they seem to be checking off their list one by one, even though we regard what they did as a strategic blunder.
It's interesting how some so-called investigative journalists like Greg Palast, for example, wrote the obituary to the neocons as if they had vanished from the scene. And what we see is their agenda, as you say, being played out. I remember Michael Ledeen, who was involved supposedly in providing the false Niger yellow cake operation. He, at one point, publicly said that what we want is chaos.
Yeah, I mean, chaos is, you know, if you look at this historically, sort of the big picture, I think a lot of this has to do with the uncertainty that came along with the end of the Cold War. You know, Jeff, you and I are old enough to remember something called the peace dividend. You remember the peace dividend?
Yes, I spent it in 5 minutes.
Yeah. Well, you know, the idea was for those who are don't recall or are maybe too young, maybe you have that demographic on this show, listening to this show. The peace dividend was this wonderful idea that at the end of the Cold War, the United States taxpayer, who had the long-suffering taxpayer who had spent all of this money and all of this energy on fighting the Soviet Union, was going to finally reap the rewards. They were going to get basically a sort of a tax holiday in a sense. And that money, instead of being spent on massive nuclear arsenals, on projecting U.S. power around the world to contain communism, that money in the 90s was finally going to come home. And it was going to rebuild roads and bridges and educate children and create the kind of economy, domestic economy, that Americans had long wished for, one that had not been around since, the time of Kennedy, right? Particularly when you think about the stagflation and the sort of the faux economy of the Reagan years. People think that the Reagan years was a great economy, but that blip only lasted a few years. And then by the end of the Reagan administration, you remember we had we had the great crash of 87, and then all of Bush Senior's administration was dealing with these economy problems. It's the economy, stupid, for Clinton to get elected. That peace dividend never really came about. But what did happen is that defense spending started to drop. And of course it's going to drop. The Cold War is over. So how do you jumpstart defense spending? And you know, that when I first read Rebuilding This America's Defenses, the thing that really stood out to me was to preserve and project American power, full spectrum dominance in the 21st century, full spectrum being control of space, control of cyberspace, control of the land, the sea, the air, control of nanotechnology, all of these things that the neocons had in their wish list in Rebuilding America's Defenses. As you pointed out in your great introduction, that was all dependent upon the coming of a new Pearl Harbor, that was the only way the American people, after a decade so of wishing for a peace dividend, that's the only way the American people were ever going to square themselves with the massive investment in the defense sector that the neocons wanted. And how do you get the American people to support that? Well, how about fear and chaos and instability? How about a massive jihadi movement sucking into the cradle of civilization and now beheading people? And you know, now you have American jihadis. It's really, in some ways, it's kind of a neocon dream come true.
It certainly is. Actually, excuse me. My guest is J.P. Sotil, and we're talking about the neocons' victory in Iraq and their plans for the future. One interesting point you made in your article, you wrote, taking out a contract on Saddam's uncooperative regime, the neocons were in fact taking out a bridge loan for their corporate sponsors until another wave of neocon men and con women, Victoria Nuland, could breathe life into the long-dead Cold War with their chess moves in Ukraine. Let's look at the Ukraine for a moment and see what is going on there. It's like people have such a short memory span, and the mainstream media has literally covered up what happened from the events in Maidan Square, in which Yanukovych had agreed with the European Union to have a new election quickly, and that might have brought in another Ukrainian government that would not have led to the confrontation we see now in East Ukraine and with Russia, and the empowering of NATO, which was trying to find a reason to exist at the end of Afghanistan. It's a big snake pit, but it all seems to come from neocons pushing it from behind the scenes and not being identified publicly as neocons, such as Victoria Nuland, whose husband, Robert Kagan, was the co-founder of the Project for New American Century and a successor of the Foreign Policy Initiative, and was McCain's foreign policy advisor and is Hillary Clinton's. But those connections are never mentioned. Maybe you could talk about them.
What's going on in Ukraine, the politics are so deep, and I'm the great Peter Dale Scott here of UC Berkeley. He came up with that idea, deep politics, many years ago. There are some deep politics at play here. It is important that you noted the connection to Hillary Clinton. You know, I do see Hillary Clinton as, I guess you would call her a left or a democratic neocon. She is essentially a neocon. I did write about this in a piece called Hillary Clinton's Weaponization of the State Department. She has, in effect, turned the State Department into an adjunct of covert military operations. And you can get that story on Consortium News or on my website, newsvandal.com. And, what you have here in Ukraine really is a coup, and I think that's how you refer. It was a coup. Victoria Nuland and Jeffrey Pyatt, also a neocon, by the way, and the neocons, the Weekly Standard, likes to have these Caribbean cruises where you can hobnob and talk with all the world's leading neocons, and there's a wonderful picture of Jeffrey Pyatt there with William Crystal and all these other neocons, you know, eating, drinking Mai Tais with guests, talking about, you know, their plans for taking over the world. It's really hilarious. In Ukraine, you have a couple of things happening. One, just weeks before the protests took off there in November, Chevron signed a 50-year lease for developing gas reserves in Ukraine. Of course, Condoleezza Rice, formerly on the board of Chevron. Chevron once had a tanker named after Condoleezza Rice. Chevron, a very big player there. That was a crucial, I see that almost as a beginning of a sort of a declaration of economic war against Russia, this signing of this deal with Chevron. And what happened was is that Russia then pressured the Ukrainian government about its pending deal with the European Union, which is why the Ukrainian government blinked and decided to forego the deal with the European Union. That then set off the protests, and that set off Nuland and Pyatt, the famous phone call with some verbiage that I can't repeat here on public radio, where Nuland said, basically, we don't care about what the EU wants. We have our people in place. And when you listen to that phone call, it's about 5 or 6 minutes. It's fascinating because it is as if they are moving chess pieces around the board. Who is going to be in government? Who do we want in? Who do we want out? Jeffrey Pyatt and Nuland sort of coming together to decide how they want the next government, the post-democratic government, maybe we'll call it, to be. But there is another subtext here, which I found very, very, very interesting, which is the role of big agriculture in Ukraine. Ukraine, at one time when it was a part of the Soviet Union, provided one quarter of the food for the Soviet Union. It was known as the breadbasket of the Soviet Union. Cargill, Monsanto, ConAgra, they are all gigantic players inside Ukraine, purchasing up farmland, purchasing up interests in large farming companies there inside the Ukraine. And of course, if you look at the U.S.-Ukraine Business Council, it is connected deeply with not only these corporations, but people like David Kramer at Freedom House, who's on the advisory board of the U.S.-Ukraine Business Council. And David Kramer used to be under the employ of Robert Kagan. David Kramer, if you go to the National Interest, there was just an article on David Kramer and how he's in the middle of a one-man crusade against Russia. Because Russia is still, when we think about the neocons, we associate them with the ROC. But I think if you look at the long history of the neocon movement, their number one target has been, is, and always will be Russia.
Exactly. I played the Nuland conversation with Pyatt what I played was her conversation with the U.S.-Ukrainian Council, in which she expressed, told them that U.S. had spent $5 billion on undermining the government. I didn't play the one where she used the F word. But it's interesting. She's kind of seems to have vanished from the headlines since they had the elections and the change of government in the Ukraine. Like, she's kind of not in the forefront of the news as she once was.
Of course, because
she's done her job.
She did her job, and also I think that there are some skeletons here for the candidacy of Hillary Clinton. This all happened, and she was. Victoria Nuland was in Hillary Clinton's State Department. Jeffrey Pyatt was in Hillary Clinton's State Department. You know, this is Hillary Clinton's State Department at work, in a sense. And even after she left, you know, the mechanisms of what she set in place are still there. And, you know, I think the media has a love-hate relationship with Hillary Clinton. There are so many juicy stories to pursue with her. But I think after Benghazi, which has led to something of a dead end, and I think a dead end for the wrong reason, because Benghazi, Reuters has done extensive reporting on how Benghazi was a primary point of weapons exports from the fallen regime of Muammar Gaddafi into rebels in Syria. That Benghazi scandal is never getting talked about. I don't know what the media is going to do with this Hillary Clinton problem. She is obviously the front runner. Elizabeth Warren is not going to challenge her, as she says repeatedly. So it's going to be something of a coronation. But if you look at what happened when she was at the State Department, sort of the freelancing, it would seem, of Victoria Nuland would reflect badly upon Hillary Clinton with her progressive base, or so you would think.
Well, obviously, it was her influence that got Nuland appointed to be the U.S. Deputy Secretary of State to,
exactly,
to Europe and Asia.
Exactly.
And Hillary Clinton has also taken Robert Kagan, who a couple of months ago in the New Republic wrote virtually a new project of New American Century, or a refurbished one for the next administration. But Robert Kagan, I predicted on an earlier program, would become a major official in Hillary's administration, if not Secretary of State, a foreign policy advisor. And what you pointed out, that what we see essentially happen in Ukraine is Hillary Clinton's State Department. And one of the problems we're going to see is that Hillary Clinton will be presented as the first woman candidate for president, and a lot of people were fooled by Obama because he was going to be the first black president, but Hillary is more of a hawk than anyone who's run for president on the Democratic Party ticket in my lifetime.
I think that's probably a fair assessment. You know, when Al Gore first ran in 88 for the nomination and he didn't get it, he and Sam Nunn were considered sort of as Democratic hawks. But Hillary Clinton, I mean, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. And if you look at it's something called the Conflict Bureau that was established during her tenure there at the State Department. What the Conflict Bureau has done and where it pops up and how it works hand in glove with U.S. Special Operations Forces and with AFRICOM around Africa, to bring this back full circle to the first, to how we opened this conversation with Wolfowitz in Africa. You know, meanwhile, there is a lot going on in Africa, and the State Department's Conflict Bureau is kind of a passkey for U.S. Special Operations Forces around Africa, and Hillary Clinton developed this. As a matter of fact, she went to a Special Operations a trade show. There is such a thing that every year in Tampa, the special forces or special operations industry, it's an industry, gets together in Tampa and has a trade show. And a couple of years ago, she went and gave the keynote address, and she, she was given a warm reception. And at this, during her remarks, keynote remarks, she said that, you know, basically the State Department needs to work or should work hand in glove with special operations around the world. I think that that's an incredibly radical thing for America's leading diplomat to say, but it went virtually unreported, save for Wired magazine and David Axe writing about it. And you know, this history of what she's done in the State Department is something that I don't think she would like to have come to light. But it's certainly something that if Rand Paul is the nominee, I guarantee you he will make an issue of.
Well, I would hope so.
You know, Jeff, I'd like to maybe put in a passing defense for journalists like Greg Pallas, who wrote off the neocons. I don't think it was that there was anything malicious about it. I think that after Obama's election, and particularly after he was able to, you know, at least temporarily extricate forces from Iraq a couple of years ago, just under two years ago, I think that it's maybe wishful thinking. I think that people were so worn out by those final few years of the Bush administration and so disillusioned by how the United States stumbled into that war, at least the American people stumbled into that war, that a lot of people wanted to write them off. But as you point out, they don't go away no matter how much people might wish for it.
Well, I just wanted to mention that the Mother Jones Magazine in the current edition has two interesting articles. One's called The Great Frack Forward, about ravenous for energy. China calls on Halliburton to go after shale gas, but it tells a whole lot more about that. And right after that is an article called The Chevron Communiques, A Trove of Secret Cables Show How Hillary Clinton's State Department Sold Fracking to the World. That's relevant to your conversation.
Yeah, and it's not surprising. And earlier, Jeff mentioned the TAPI pipeline. That's the Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India pipeline. It's a pipeline that's supposed to deliver Caspian Sea oil and gas reserves out of the Caspian Sea region and down into a port in Pakistan and off into the Indian Ocean. And that thing has been stalled, at least mostly stalled, for the last few years. But as of about 3 months ago, the State Department was hosting negotiations between Chevron and the interested parties to try and get that pipeline built. You know, the State Department is essentially a business agent for Chevron and has been for many years.
Well, thank you for that caller, that piece of information. I'm going to check Mother Jones' article out. We're coming down to the end of the very interesting hour. JP, how do people reach you and read your writings? They're very interesting writings, and I've been following them for some time. How do people get in touch with you or find your writings?
Well, you can go to newsvandal.com. I do link everything that I write for other websites, including Consortium News, Guardian, and others. And if you'd like to get a daily rundown of news that I aggregate every Monday through Friday morning, just email me at info@newsvandal.com. That's info@newsvandal.com.
That's N-E-W-S-V-A-N-D-A-L, one word.
Correct.
Well, JP, again, thanks so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World. I look forward to having you back again and reading your writings, because I find you're probing into areas that need to be probed, like other journalists are not doing, or not enough journalists are doing. So thanks so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World.